The next case on calendar is Marcus A. Leaf. By and through his conservator Cindy Reef versus Aries Consultants, Nevada Corporation, case number 76121. Ready to go, Mr. Westbrook? Okay, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Randolph Westbrook, attorney for the appellant, Marcus Reef. With this court's approval, I would like to request 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
The central issue before us today is whether a district court can add additional requirements that go beyond the plain language of the statute. NRS 11.258 requires an attorney affidavit, an expert report to be filed prior to service of the initial pleading in the matter. Here, the district court erred when it determined the statute requires these supporting documents to be filed concurrently with the complaint. For this reason, we urge the court to reverse the lower court's decision and hold that the appellant in fact satisfied NRS 11.258 because the attorney affidavit and expert report were on file with the district court at the time the first pleading was served in this matter.
Mr. Westbrook?
Yes.
Who does the attorney refer to? Does it have to be the person who is, you know, drafting the complaint? Does it have to be a Nevada lawyer? We say the attorney. Who are we talking about?
I believe it refers to the attorney who represents the plaintiff. In this case, the plaintiff had multiple attorneys, one being a California attorney. He's represented by the attorney licensed in Nevada, Mr. Glenn Lerner. And if we look to the court's decision in Zohar and Baxter, in which the court stated that all exhibits attached to a pleading are considered incorporated within that pleading, the amended pleading here was included an attachment of an attorney affidavit. The amended complaint was signed by Mr. Glenn Lerner. So based on this court's ruling in Zohar and Baxter, that affidavit from Mr. Shea was read as being incorporated into Mr. Lerner's amended complaint.
Well, this is a little bit different situation than Baxter. The statute itself requires that the affidavit be signed by the attorney. And it is a, I get your point about service versus filing. That leads to a separate question I have. But on this point, why wouldn't we require the attorney to be a licensed attorney in the state or pro hac vici admitted in the case that's been filed?
Well, there was a pro hac pending in the matter. However, the
district wasn't granted. It hadn't been acted on yet.
Correct, Your Honor.
Isn't the intent of the statute to require that a licensed attorney in this state, when they're referring to the attorney, be the one who signs the affidavit because there is an issue of accountability?
Well, I believe the intent of the statute is to determine that the action has merit that warrants judicial expenditure of resources and time. So you have a licensed attorney.
You think the legislature contemplated allowing any attorney in the world to sign the affidavit, and that's good enough?
I think the legislature contemplated that they want someone licensed to practice law to say that this action had a reasonable basis in both law and fact, to move forward. I believe that was the legislative intent.
Would that constitute the unauthorized practice of law by that attorney?
No, I do not believe so, because the attorney represented Mr. Reef in a separate action in the Nevada court.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, he spoke up in a different action, not in the underlying action. As Your Honor stated, it was not granted, but we didn't get to that part because the district court vacated the hearing and pro hoc motion.
You folks spent a lot of time briefing and arguing about what happened or didn't happen with the clerk's office. But as near as I can tell, nobody referenced the Nevada Electronic Filing Rules 15B2. Why not?
Your Honor, Under my reading of the statute, the technical deficiencies don't play a bearing on NRS 11.258. We were showing what happened in the explanation.
I'm asking about the electronic filing rules, which specifically identify a remedy associated with a problem where there's a filing problem, as you allege, occurred with the clerk.
Well, Your Honor, we had debated internally what to do, and we came to the conclusion that filing an amended complaint with the attached exhibits was the best course of action.
Yeah. I'm asking why a rule that specifically addresses a technical problem with the filing of a complaint wasn't briefed in this case.
Well, because the reason why the motion was granted to dismiss our complaint was because the district court determined that our original complaint was void ab initio because we didn't file it with the attorney affidavit and expert report.
Okay, there does seem to be a problem, maybe that was created in the Okada case, where the difference in medical malpractice between filing and architectural malpractice service wasn't recognized appropriately. You're asking us to address that in this case?
Well, I'm asking you to define that the triggering event for rendering a complaint void under NRS 11.258 is serving a pleading prior to the filing of the attorney affidavit and expert report. That's not what happened here. At the time we served, the first pleading that was served in this matter, the attorney affidavit and expert report were on file with the district court in accordance with 11.258.
Which one was served on the defendant? The second filed set of documents or the first set of documents?
The amended complaint was the first pleading filed on the defendant down below.
All right.
This issue boils down to statutory interpretation, in which this court's ultimate goal is to give full effect to legislative intent. This court will look at the plain language in the statute to glean such intent, and I submit that you don't have to look beyond the statute to find out what the legislator intended.
Is there any guidance in the legislative history about what the legislature intended when they said attorney affidavit?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that first.
Is there any legislative history that provides guidance to this court and to legislative intent over what the legislature meant when they used the attorney?
Your Honor, I did not find anything. I looked in the two sessions from 2007, and the main crux of the proposition was how it affected the valley and how it affected design professionals and what the statute was intended to do. And the statute was intended to ensure that claims had some merit before design professionals got pulled into an action. Keep in mind at this time, around 2007, there was a boom of construction defect claims. And a lot of design professionals were getting pulled in. And as this panel knows, once you get pulled into a lawsuit, it's hard to get out. So the design professionals wanted a hurdle, a checkpoint, if you will, to ensure that these claims had some merit. And that's what this was designed to do. Mr. Mark Ferrario, and he spoke in support of the bill, explicitly stated that this statute was not designed to bar legitimate claims. If you look at the expert report that was attached to the amended complaint, we have an expert who reviewed it and said that we have a reasonable basis in both law and fact to bring the claim. Back to the interpretation of the statute. The statute is clear and unambiguous. It plainly states that the attorney affidavit and expert report must be filed prior to the service of the initial pleading. Here we did just that. The initial pleading that was served was the amended complaint. At the time it was served, the attorney affidavit and expert report were on file. Now, the district court stated that we couldn't file an amended complaint because the original complaint was void ab initio. As I stated earlier, and as Justice Harvesty stated in the Ota case, that's incorrect. The triggering event that renders it void ab initio is service of initial pleading prior to an attorney affidavit and expert report being filed with the district court. Now, the respondent asserts a different interpretation, which states that the language concurrently with service of the initial pleading actually means the first pleading filed in the matter. Had the legislator intended that, they would have said so in the statute. Just like they did in the medical malpractice statute, NRS 418.071, where it said the affidavit had to be filed with a complaint. Here, they didn't do that. It was a living, breathing document at the time we filed the amended complaint, because the triggering event hadn't happened yet. So under NRCP 15, we were free to amend the complaint, and we did just that. Once we amended the complaint, we attached the attorney affidavit and expert report, thereby satisfying NRS 11.258. Now, I recognize we have competing interpretations, which ultimately can lead to an ambiguity. However, which means this court must look to legislative intent. However, as discussed before, the legislator did not intend cases like these to be barred from the courts. Cases like these were designed to go forward. We consulted with an expert prior to filing a complaint. There was a misstep on our part. When the original complaint was filed, the expert report and attorney affidavit were not uploaded. Less than 24 hours later, we uploaded an amended complaint that included the attorney affidavit and an expert report. Further, if this panel chooses to follow the respondent's interpretation, it ultimately leads to an absurd result. Under the respondent's interpretation, had we filed the original complaint and then filed two rogue documents, an attorney affidavit and expert report, we would have satisfied the statute. However, because we filed an amended complaint, for some reason now our attorney affidavit and expert report are no good, it runs counter to legislative intent. This statute, again, was not designed to hold out cases like these. Essentially, what the respondent is trying to do is use a technicality to get out of defending a claim. Again, not the intent of the statute. Further, the amended pleading was, in fact, the operative pleading in this matter. So even if this court wants to apply the respondent's interpretation of NRS 11.258, we still satisfy the statute. As I stated before, the triggering event that would have rendered the complaint void ab initio had not occurred. There was no service. So we were free to amend, and we did just that. This court stated in Las Vegas Network B. Shaw Cross & Associates that a amended pleading supersedes a prior pleading as a pleading. Meaning, once we filed that amended pleading, it was now the operative pleading and the one that was to be served on the respondent. Otherwise, interpreting the statute as the respondent wishes this court to do would completely run counter to NRCP 15, which allows free amendments. Further, the respondent raised two issues in his brief. I believe I addressed one of them regarding the attorney affidavit requirement. However, he raised an issue regarding the expert report. Now, these issues were not placed before the district court. The district court in the order specifically declined to address them, so I don't feel they're ripe for review for this court. However, if this court would like me to address the expert report, the expert report, I will do so.
I think that would be wise.
So the respondent states that the expert report has to be designed specifically for this particular action. Again, he's reading requirements into the statute that just aren't there. The legislative intent regarding the expert report is that whatever event or occurrence that gave rise to the action, there was a reasonable basis of law and fact stemming from that event to bring the claim in the district court. That's what we have here. We admit there's technical deficiencies in the complaint when the wrong case number is presented on there. However, the facts are the same. The facts are the same as the action that was in front of the Honorable Judge East. So, of course, it's going to be the same report because nothing changed. Tossing out the expert report because the wrong case number was on it would run counter to the legislative intent. It essentially gives the respondent a technical loophole to escape defending a claim, which is not what the legislative intended and not what the state stands for. This court and many district courts have repeatedly stated that we prefer to have cases judged on the merits as opposed as technical deficiencies. With that, I'm over my time. If there's any other questions, I'd like to reserve the remaining for rebuttal.
Yes, sir. That'd be fine.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court, Robert Schumacher for the appellant. First off, the appellant characterizes this appeal as one involving matters of first impression and matters of public import. Respondent disagrees, disputes that this appeal involves matters of first impression. In fact, the OTAC case authored by Your Honor can summarily address the issues addressed in this appeal. Respondent agrees that the issues in this appeal are matters of public import for reasons I'll explain. This panel should note that there is a pending appeal involving what you heard referred to as the initial action that was pending before Judge Weiss in Department 30. That Supreme Court case number is 79067. It involves the same parties, the same issues, the same facts that are the subject of this appeal. Appellant conveniently glosses over this related appeal in its briefing and argument today. The facts and circumstances, particularly the pleadings and the court filings made by appellant in the earlier case with Judge Weiss, are germane to this panel's determination of this appeal. Appellant cleverly attempts to direct this panel's attention to what occurred in Judge Johnson's court below, and argues and characterizes the complaint filed in Judge Susan Johnson's courtroom as the initial pleading, and the amended pleading in Judge Johnson's court as the second pleading. The reality is this, that in 2017, appellant filed a complaint involving the same parties, the same facts, and the same issues, and it went to Judge Weiss. That was the first pleading. They argue that at that time they were not aware that the respondent was and is a design professional. Judge Weiss was kind, in our opinion, and allowed them some time to conduct discovery to ascertain that indeed respondent was and is a design professional. Importantly, at that point in time, the appellant filed a first amended complaint in the initial action. They failed again, a second time, to comply with NRS 11.258. Specifically, they didn't file the attorney affidavit, or any expert report. When appellant realized that they had made a mistake, instead of dealing with it in Judge Weiss's court, they simply filed a second duplicative action while the first action was pending in Clark County District Court, and it went to Judge Weiss. We refer to that as the do-over complaint because it mirrored almost identically what was contained in the first complaint. And by doing that, and by arguing that was their first pleading, and that the amended pleading in Judge Johnson's court, which really was the fourth pleading, the fourth attempt to get it right, they still haven't got it right. And Justice Hardesty, you alluded to this. I think it strains credulity to infer or interpret the statute to say that any attorney in the world can sign the attorney affidavit that is required by the legislature in NRS 11.258. Appellant asked this panel to consider the horrendous injuries to the plaintiff. That should not be a factor in this court's determination today.
But before you leave that point, though, Mr. Schumacher, I'd like to ask a hypothetical. Is there anything in 11.258 that precludes the plaintiff in an action to file wrongly without the affidavit? The court in that case dismisses the case, and while the statute of limitations is still open, file a new action. I don't read 11.258 as precluding them from filing a new action. What's the bar to that?
Justice Hardesty, we agree with your interpretation. However, those aren't the facts in this case.
How do they differ?
They differ because the action in Judge Weiss's case was not dismissed. During the pendency of that case, they filed another action. Okay. They didn't even wait for it to get dismissed.
That's a fair point, but what in 11.258 prevents them from filing a second or subsequent action that essentially asserts the same. There's no doubt a number of legal theories that bars the filing of repeated lawsuits that are the same, but none of that's been briefed here, nor raised here, nor was it, and I'm not being critical because it wasn't really posted up for this case. This case comes to us as a result of a dismissal on this procedural problem. But I want to get to the point you're making, which is, seems to be that, or you're inferring, and I assume you're not, that as long as the statute of limitations hasn't run, as would have occurred here in this case, allegedly on March 16th, that they could file a new case. There's nothing, at least in 11258, that precludes them from doing so. Is that right?
Well, let me try and dissect that, because okay. you put forth two prongs.
Sure.
And I agree that if the initial action is dismissed, albeit without prejudice, and the applicable statute of limitations still allows a remedy to the complainant, that they could file a second subsequent action. However, while the first action is pending, they can't simply file a second action. I mean, think about the implications. Somebody files an action in state court, they don't like how things are going, and they simply file a second action, hoping that they'll get more favorable results. And where does it end? Do they go to federal court? Do they file a third action, and so on and so on?
I think there's a lot of law out there that precludes people from filing repetitive causes of action or repetitive actions, but that is different. I'm just focused on what 11258 permits or doesn't. By the way, are you asking this court to take judicial notice of the other action and its current disposition?
Yes, and in fact, it's discussed in the briefing both by
sure.
appellant and by respondent. And we did brief in the lower court the single cause of action rule issue.
Right.
But
the judge didn't reach that issue here.
She did not. She considered it, but didn't make a ruling on it. We're
yeah.
referring to Judge Johnson.
Johnson.
However, as this panel or another of the Supreme Court may soon learn, Judge Weiss essentially did. And perhaps the appeal should have been consolidated. I don't know. The timing was rather odd, how the first action was adjudicated later than the one with Judge Johnson.
But is the briefing in 79067 done?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I think that...
And are all of you counsel the same counsel in that case, Mr.?
Yes.
You're not counsel in that case, Mr. Westbrook? Okay. Is Mr. Lerner?
Ms. Lerner counsel.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
So to get back to answer your question, if the first action is dismissed, albeit without prejudice, and the statute of limitations is open, NRS 11.258 does not bar the filing of a second action. But again, that is not the facts of this case.
Mm-hmm.
You have a pending action and then a concurrent action going marching along separately. And I would suggest to this court, based on longstanding Nevada jurisprudence, that when the initial complaint was filed with Judge Peace, that was the first pleading within the contemplation of NRS 11.258. 11.258 states in pertinent part, except as otherwise provided in subsection 2, in an action involving non-residential construction, the attorney for the complainant shall file an affidavit with the court concurrently with the service of the first pleading in the action, stating that the attorney, and then it goes on to lay out the requirements, and then it addresses the expert report, actually. And I'd like to address just a couple of the points where appellant had talked about this triggering event. Respondent would suggest to this court that the triggering event was the service of the initial complaint and the First Amendment complaint in the initial action, not the service of the original complaint or the amended complaint in the second action. Plaintiff had four bites at the apple, first pleading, second pleading, third pleading, fourth pleading, and they didn't get it right in the fourth pleading because the gentleman who signed the attorney affidavit did not have a pro hac vice application pending for this case. There was one relative to the initial action, but those cases were not consolidated. And the rules are very clear. Just because you get admitted to one case, and even though the parties are overlapping and the facts and circumstances similar, even identical, does not entitle you to practice in the second case. You have to submit another one. And anything done by that attorney who is not pro hac in on the second case would be the unlicensed practice of law. So the triggering event occurred during Judge Weiss's case. And it's interesting. We have, relative to the complaint, the first complaint in Judge Johnson's court, where they allege there is this technical glitch. Now, mind you, they blew it the first time, they blew it the second time with Judge Weiss, they blew it the third time with Judge Johnson, and then finally, the fourth time, they got it right. They blamed the electronic filing system, they throw a clerk under the bus, and yet they still have not got it right. The point is this. On March 12, 2018, appellant filed its initial complaint with Judge Johnson. Okay? Appellant claims there was a filing anomaly that prevented it again from including the requisite affidavit and expert report. So the next day, they filed the amended complaint. Tellingly, in their in appellant's brief, on page 1 of the statement of facts, there's a footnote, footnote 1. And they refer to the amended complaint in Judge Johnson's courtroom as their second pleading. So they admit in their own briefing that they didn't do what's required under 11.258 with the first pleading, which really should be the third pleading for purposes of this panel's analysis. This court needs to look at and examine and include in its evaluation, its determination of this issue, this appeal, the facts and circumstances that transpired in Judge Weiss's courtroom. To do otherwise is going to open the floodgates. You will have people filing concurrent lawsuits in the lower court level. You can't have that for obvious reasons. Appellant talks about the draconian nature of NRS 11.258 and the harsh consequences that would befall it should the court affirm the lower court's, Judge Johnson's, order dismissing their second do-over complaint. But the reality is this. The filing of the second do-over complaint was a very clever effort to circumvent the effect of NRS 11.258. What they're attempting to do is rectify mistakes they made once, twice in the original action, and it's them that caused these harsh results. Anytime a party litigant dislikes a trial court's ruling, they can simply refile a second complaint? No. But yet, that's what they're asking this court to do. If this court reverses Judge Johnson's ruling granting the motion to dismiss, it will encourage every party litigant to simply refile another complaint. The proper vehicle for appellant is not filing a second action. It's appealing the first action. And that, indeed, is what they did. Does that mean my time's up, or am I?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We would ask the court to affirm the lower court decision.
Mr. Schumacher, could you do you have handy the date on which the Weiss order dismissing the first cause of action occurred?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
May 21st, 2019. And we had filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings that Judge Weiss converted to a motion for summary judgment. And it essentially addressed the same issues and facts that we're talking about here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel the need to remind this panel why we're here. We're not here because of anything that happened in any of the court outside of Judge Johnson's court. The issue on appeal is whether or not Judge Johnson got it right when she dismissed our complaint as void ab initio because it was not filed with an attorney affidavit and expert report. Again, I submit that that was an error. The district court applied the incorrect standard. The district court applied the medical malpractice standard that stated the affidavit must be filed with the complaint. She did not apply the non-residential construction standard, which states that the affidavit and expert report must be filed concurrently with service of the initial pleading in the matter.
Mr. Westbrook, if we agreed with you and said she got that piece wrong, wouldn't we have to remand it for her to reach the other issues, one being the single action rule?
Yes, Your Honor, because she explicitly stated that she was not addressing those issues. So I believe it would have to be remanded to the district court.
Which court's the proper court to hear the one action complaint?
The district court in front of Judge Johnson, because that's where the argument was raised. Secondly,
well, counsel has represented to us that issue was raised before Weiss.
Yes, Your Honor, but this action is appealed from order for Judge Johnson.
No, I appreciate that point, but is it the case, or you're not familiar with the outcome of the first action in Weiss's courtroom?
Under my impression, the single action rule was raised in front of Judge Johnson because there was a pending case with Judge Weiss based on the respondent's assertions.
Maybe I poorly phrased my question. Did Judge Weiss address the single action rule in dismissing the first case?
No, the first case was dismissed because of the failure to comply with NRS 11.258.
Okay. All right. Was there anything else you wanted to add before?
Just a summation.
Okay.
We satisfy the statute. The plain language of the statute says that we need to get the report, an affidavit, on file before we serve the complaint. We did that here. There's nothing in the NRS 11.258 that says that we need to refer to other actions in front of other courts or other judges. It says concurrently with service in the action, not in any action. With that, I will submit my argument.
Okay, gentlemen.